When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, and welcome to the Latin American History Podcast. Episode 108, A History of Mesoamerican Food, Part 1. The food of Mesoamerica, Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, is some of the best in Latin America, in the world even. Almost every town of any size in Europe, North America, or Oceania has a Mexican restaurant, testament to it being one of the world's great culinary traditions. Although what they serve is often not completely representative of the real thing. Other parts of Latin America have strong food traditions and plenty of great food. However, in my opinion, besides Argentina and the Southern Cone, it's Mexico where you'll find the deepest and richest range of dishes and ingredients. There is quite a lot of interesting history involved in Mesoamerican food. Although I will mention a lot of dishes and recommend some of them, this isn't going to be an episode simply about cooking or listing my favourite foods. Like with the history of music episodes we did recently, I want to try to talk about how some of these things came about. As we saw in those music episodes, most of Latin American cultural expression, including Mesoamerica's food, is the result of a blend of the European and the indigenous. As in the rest of Latin America, the African inheritance also played a part. However, in this case, less so than in music or in the cuisine of other parts of Latin America, like Brazil, the Caribbean Islands, or Colombia. There are also elements from less obvious places, like the Middle East, and dispersed parts of Europe besides Spain. One of the reasons that food culture is so rich here is because the pre-Hispanic culture was already so strong and distinctive. Each indigenous group was and is unique, but they drew from a pool of cultural elements, sharing things like deities, for example, and adding their own variations. The food of the Maya, Aztec, Zapotec, and Olmec were different, but they shared recognizable features, like the reliance on the tortilla. Most tortillas, of course, are made of corn. The earliest evidence for the domestication of corn comes from a cave in the Mexican state of Oaxaca, named Gilia Naquitz. This means that people there were deliberately planting a wild ancestor plant of corn, taking the first steps into farming and inspiring the genetic changes which made that plant develop into the corn we know today. It wasn't just corn they were growing there, though. Beans, squash, and gourds were farmed, and a variety of pumpkin, which seems to have been deliberately grown there, dates back further than anything else. In fact, this is the first evidence of farming we have anywhere in North America. Today's Western farming methods have grown out of Western culture, which puts the individual and the concept of private property at the heart of things. Of course, this has been brought to Mesoamerica, and so much farmland is today owned by individuals or corporations. However, this was not how things were done before the Spanish conquest. In Europe, we used to have a type of land known as the commons, communally owned places which everyone could use for producing food. In Mesoamerica, similar concepts existed. Much land in Mexico is still known as ejido land today, and this is collectively owned by the community rather than one individual. The modern ejido was instated after the Mexican Revolution, and it has some influence from these old European property rights concepts. A large part of it, though, is to recognise indigenous ways of using land and the food which it produces. In some places, most notably among the Maya of the Yucatan Peninsula in Chiapas, the milpa system survives. This is primarily a way of producing crops for food, but it is also a way of creating social and communal bonds which help order society. At its heart is the idea of rotating crops, corn, beans and squash mainly, and leaving each piece of land uncultivated at times as well. This ensures that the whole community has a variety of crops to provide them with a balanced diet, but also that the land does not become unproductive through overuse of one single plant. Now, the system does not produce huge surplus yields which can be turned into profits when sold. It does, however, create balance and sustainability within the health of the land, the diet of those involved, and the community which it binds together. It's impossible to say how far back these systems of land use go, but presumably it's thousands of years. Corn was used in many different ways, but it was and is the tortilla, which is probably most ubiquitous. The flour of the corn is turned into dough, rolled into small balls, and then pressed into flat, round discs. It's cooked very briefly on a hot plate, then they are stacked and sold very cheaply. You can see this being done everywhere from inside wooden shacks in remote highland villages in Guatemala to the market stalls of major Mexican cities. Today, round metal plates are often used to cook them, but you can sometimes see the heated stone domes still being utilised, a scene which hasn't changed much for millennia, and witnessing it is a piece of cultural expression which I recommend seeking out if you ever visit the region. The smell given off by the little discs of cooking corn flour is incredibly tempting. You can, of course, buy mass-produced tortillas in Western countries, although it can be harder to find the ones made from corn. Wheat tortillas are not inauthentic, although the use of this plant is something which developed after the Spanish had brought it over from Europe. It is a genuine part of the food culture, linked to the north of Mexico primarily. Even the wheat tortillas in Mexico are somehow better than those you can buy in the rest of the world. I don't know how to describe it, but those from a supermarket in Mexico are better than foreign ones. Floppier, yet somehow stronger, and of course, better tasting. In Western countries, the palate is more used to wheat-based baking, and so perhaps this is the main reason that it's hard to find corn tortillas abroad. But the cost involved in making the corn ones might also contribute. Corn has to go through an extra step to be used. Now we know that this chemical reaction was discovered over 1,000 years ago. There is evidence of it being done in Guatemala, possibly as long as 1,500 years ago. Basically, it involves soaking corn over a heat in an alkaline liquid for a while. In Mesoamerica, this is lime, the stone compound, not the fruit. But it spread north into today's USA and south all the way to the Andes, and different alkalines are used in these places. There are loads of reasons why this improves the tortilla making process. Firstly, ground corn will not combine with water to form dough if the process hasn't taken place. It also kills off various toxic fungi, which sometimes live on the corn, thus making it safer to eat. Finally, though, it changes the chemical composition of the corn. In its natural state, much of the nutrients cannot be digested by the human body. They pass right through without providing any of the benefits. This might not be an issue if corn is one part of a wider diet, but when it's a staple food, as it was and still is in Mesoamerica, this can become a problem. You might be eating enough to satisfy your hunger, but if a large part of your diet is unprocessed in this way, you risk malnutrition. The process is called nixtamalization, and it's also said to make the end result tastier. Besides tortillas, the other thing which probably races to mind when Mesoamerican food is mentioned is of course the chili. This too is indigenous to the region, and has probably been used from the very beginning. It was domesticated in Mexico at least 6,000 years ago, and is one of the first plants to be so. Bartolomé de las Casas wrote very soon after the conquest by Hernán Cortés that indigenous Mesoamericans didn't consider themselves to actually be eating unless their food contained chili. We also know that it was used as a type of biological weapon in pre-Hispanic times. Dried chilies would be set on fire so that the irritants would be carried in the smoke. It was apparently quite effective against Spanish horses. Sometimes grenades were made from dried chili and embers placed in gourds. These could then be thrown at the enemy. Chili is, of course, the basis of today's pepper spray. Perhaps the final emblematic ingredient of Mexican cooking are beans, particularly the refried ones which accompany many meals. These are beans which have been boiled and then crushed into a paste. Lard, herbs, and other things are added before it's fried just before serving. Strains of the bean plant are found all over the world, with some varieties coming to Mesoamerica with the Spanish. Others, though, were domesticated in the region and spread to other parts of the Americas before the European arrival. All of these pre-Hispanic staples, then, survived the conquest and are still pillars of Mesoamerican food today. Indigenous Mesoamericans complemented them with a range of other natural ingredients, all of which are also still in common use. Native fruits and vegetables like avocado, squash, cassava, pineapple, guava, and sweet potato are all examples. Chocolate, too, was a plant which was of importance. Its very name is derived from Nahuatl, the language of the Aztec, although there is dispute about which of their words it developed from. The word cacao is probably the origin of the Spanish cacao and the English cocoa. It might be that chocolate was a corruption of cacahuatl, cocoa water, xocohuatl, bitter drink, chocolatl, hot water, or chicolatl, which has an unknown meaning. The plant actually comes from South America, probably Ecuador, but it spread across the tropical Americas thousands of years ago. Mesoamericans consumed it in a very different way to the one we know. As those Nahuatl words suggest, it was made into a hot drink, and as sugar did not arrive until the conquest, it was unsweetened. Vanilla and chili were added instead. Europeans replicated this with their own ingredients, but it wasn't until the Industrial Revolution that milk began to be used, and that it became popular to consume it as a food rather than a drink. It wasn't simply something to be consumed in Mesoamerica. It had a greater social significance. The Aztec and the Maya believed that it had been provided by the gods, and it was used in religious ceremonies. Your average person probably wouldn't have had much access to it. It was something consumed by the elites. The raw beans were also sometimes used as currency. Today you can get an idea of how it might have tasted in its pre-Hispanic form if you order mole negro. There are loads of moles. They are all types of sauce, often simply differentiated by their colour. Mole negro, then, is the black mole, and its colour comes from the chocolate used to make it. Moles are one of the most developed, complex, and popular parts of Mesoamerican cuisine. Many have dozens of ingredients, including chilies, fruits, seeds, and nuts. Mole negro can confuse your taste buds at first. It's often served on top of chicken, and you can taste the chocolate, but combined with all the other ingredients in a savoury dish and completely unsweetened, it's something which you will probably not be used to if you don't have prior exposure to it. It is delicious, though. It comes from the state of Oaxaca, as do many of the other moles, and Oaxaca is sometimes seen as the place where Mesoamerican cuisine is most highly developed. It is a very indigenous state, and so this demonstrates just how much the indigenous inheritance is valued, when it comes to food at least. Puebla and Tlaxcala are also places where moles are an important part of the culture. Now there is one mole which you'll probably know, guacamole. The Spanish for avocado is aguacate, except in a few South American countries where it's called palta, a word which comes from Quechua. Aguacate comes from Nahuatl, and the tree itself originally comes from southern Mexico and Guatemala, being domesticated in Mesoamerica. Guacamole, then, means avocado sauce. In a second, we will talk about the Columbian Exchange, which saw many things, including food, cross back and forth between Europe and the Americas, and then to the wider world. One of the things which came to the Americas was the selection of animals, which in the West and subsequently in Mesoamerica are most commonly eaten. In pre-Hispanic Mesoamerica, though, before this had taken place, different types of meat were consumed. Turkey and deer were among the most common, as was seafood and fish on the coast and near lakes. Insects were also consumed, and they still are today. If you walk through one of the great markets of Mexican cities, seeking out those tortillas being cooked which I mentioned earlier, you will probably also come across huge open sacks overflowing with produce for sale. There will be an infinite variety of dried chilies, but you will probably also see chapulines, grasshoppers. So that Columbian Exchange I just mentioned changed the world. Apart from the conquests and the power and riches it brought to Spain, which we've already looked at in detail on this podcast, and which changed the course of geopolitical history, all sorts of other things crossed the Atlantic. This included everything from abstract concepts like ideas, to diseases, to food and animals. Food can give an idea of things which went the other way. The tomato, the chili, and the potato were unknown outside of the Americas beforehand, for example, and these had a huge impact on the cuisines of places far beyond Spain. Can you imagine Italian food without the tomato, or Indian cuisine without the chili?
At Humana, our Medicare Advantage plans give you coverage and care you can count on, along with guided support to help you feel your best. You could have a plan with a $0 premium or an all-in-one plan that may include medical and prescription coverage, as well as routine dental, vision, and hearing. Learn more at GetHumana.com. Humana, a more human way to healthcare. Humana is a Medicare Advantage HMO and PPO organization with a Medicare contract. Enrollment in any Humana plan depends on contract renewal.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I've already mentioned a couple of things which came to Mesoamerica, such as the wheat used in some tortillas. This moment was when the other pillar of the region's cuisine developed, as with much of the rest of its culture. We can start with the meats, as we have just mentioned them, and because it's one of the biggest contributions of the Spanish. Today you are more likely to come across meat derived from the cow, pig, chicken and goat, than any indigenous animal of Mesoamerica. These all came from Europe. Things like chicharrón, deep-fried pork skin, are now found all over Latin America, and they have their origin in Spain. Sausage culture is another thing which the Spanish excel at, and which took over across Latin America. Spain has its chorizos and longanisas, which actually vary from Spanish region to Spanish region. Often in Mesoamerica and in the rest of the world, people talk about Spanish chorizo, but there are many different types. So too in Latin America, chorizo and longaniza can be very different in different places. In Mesoamerica, you might see chorizo argentino sold in supermarkets alongside Spanish chorizo and local varieties. In my opinion, the best Mesoamerican sausage is the longaniza de Valladolid. It can be found elsewhere, but its home, and where it's easiest to obtain, is in the small Yucatan town from which it gets its name. Despite the tropical climate, you will often see it for sale wrapped in paper and unrefrigerated in the Yucatan. That's the best and most authentic stuff. It has a unique taste and colour. Spanish chorizo is red because of the addition of paprika. Longaniza de Valladolid is even more crimson, and this is because its meat is dyed with the achote plant. The wood of the same tree is used to smoke it, and this gives it a really distinct and powerful flavour. Its texture is almost crumbly, and it will fall apart when you cut it up to put inside tacos. Today it's usually made from pork, but originally deer meat was used. The Yucatan is a hotbed for meat dishes, which, like the longaniza de Valladolid, personify that mix of indigenous and Spanish traditions. I don't know if the longaniza was developed by Spanish colonists using the ingredients they found available to them in the New World, but I do know that the Maya of the region took the pork brought by the Spanish and used their own techniques to make two more excellent dishes. My favourite is cochinita pibil. The cochinita part of the name refers to the fact that it's made from the pork of young pigs. The pibil part is a reference to the way it's cooked. Like many cultures, such as the Maori in New Zealand with their hangis, or the Aboriginal people of Western Australia who use a similar technique to cook emu, the Maya in the Yucatan sometimes cook meat by burying the animal whole in the ground, alongside hot coals, and leaving it there for many hours. In this case, the pork is marinated with the acidic juices of oranges or limes, and the whole process creates a meat which is soft enough to pull apart and full of flavour. Pork chuck is made using a similar marinade of orange juice, but the pork is served in little pieces rather than being pulled apart. If tortillas and chilies are usually the most common ingredients thought of when it comes to Mesoamerican cuisine, the myriad of ways in which they are combined probably spring to mind first when you think about Mexican dishes. Now that we've looked at how beef, pork and chicken arrive to complement these ingredients, we can start to look at how they come together. Many Mesoamerican dishes involve taking a filling and wrapping it in a tortilla in one way or another. Tacos, flautas, burritos, quesadillas and enchiladas are all well known, and they are all variants of this form. It can get confusing looking at a menu in Mexico due to all the options. Alongside those just mentioned, you'll see lesser-known ones, like the sincronizada and the gringa. These two use the same basic element. Honduran baleadas and Salvadorian pupusas are also part of the same family of dishes, although the pupusa creates a stuffed cake from the corn flour, rather than shaping it into tortillas. This is probably more or less how things were before the Spanish arrived, but their arrival has meant that the fillings have changed. To take the cochinita pibil example, a menu might have a list of meat-based fillings and a list of ways in which they can be served. In tacos, in flautas, in gringas, or even by the kilogram if you want to share it out across a table or take it home. There are as many fillings as there are tortilla preparation variants. You will see things like pastor, barbacoa, carnitas, birria, and arrachera all over the place. All of these involve the meats brought over from Spain, cooked in different ways or prepared using different cuts. Things like cabeza, lengua, and tripa are made from the bits of the animal which we have become squeamish about in the West. So although they are still very tasty, that's something to be aware of if you want to avoid ordering that kind of thing. Pastor is probably the meat with the most interesting history. In Mexico, you might notice what looks like kebab meat rotating in front of a vertical grill in the front window of street restaurants. The first time I came to Mexico, it was an unexpected reminder of home, as we love kebabs in Britain, and every high street in the country has at least a couple of takeaway shops selling them. Now, these have a common origin to pastor. This method of meat preparation is common all over the Middle East. And while Turkish people brought it to Britain, it was Lebanese immigrants who brought it to Mexico. You will find people of Lebanese descent all over Latin America. Nayib Bukele, the current president of El Salvador, is one example. As is the Mexican Carlos Slim, who was the world's richest man for a few years last decade. It is one of Latin America's lesser-known sources of immigration. Lebanon has a large Christian community, which is why they often use pork for their kebabs, not having the prohibition against it which exists in Islam. The Lebanese population in and around Mexico City started making their kebabs, and then adapted them to local flavours by adding the red adobada marinade, and by serving it in tortillas. It quickly became hugely popular amongst the rest of the Mexican population, and now it's ubiquitous. You can still get the original version, although it's less popular than pastor. If you see Tacos Arabes, Arab tacos, for sale, that's it. Perhaps it's not surprising that this Middle Eastern food caught on in Mexico. After all, Spanish food itself is heavily influenced by the hundreds of years in which what is now its territory was part of the Islamic world. Rice, for example, so fundamental to dishes like paella, and in the way it was prepared, as well as too many Latin American dishes, was introduced to Iberia from the Middle East. So too were things like churros, which have also found popularity in Mexico. If I had to pick one type of food which I love the most, it would probably be cheese. In this, I'm very European. The smellier and stronger the cheese, the better. I'm not generally very snobby about food and food culture, but this is one of the few things which I think can only really be found in its best form in Europe. The stuff which is called cheddar elsewhere, for example, is absolutely nothing like an actual cheddar, which makes the mouth tingle with its sharpness, and which often has a crunch to it from the solidified crystals of calcium. Besides Argentina, with its recent European immigration, and where some good cheese can be found, this is one of the things I miss most when in Latin America. Mexico, though, does have one of the strongest cheese cultures in the region. You won't find the mouldy, stinky stuff you find in Europe, but there is good cheese in Mexico. Much of it is fresh cheese rather than the aged type. Often it's made at small scale by individual farmers. The highland climate of Chiapas makes it a good place for dairy production, with queso de bola being a popular type. Queso Oaxaca is another common cheese, which comes in the form of long, thick strands. Just a few days ago, I was eating tacos in a market in Merida, and I was surprised to see a man of about 20, with blue eyes and blonde hair, wearing dungarees and a straw hat, going from table to table, selling homemade cheese. He was a Mennonite, part of a religious community with roots in Germany, who live in closed settlements, and are related to the Amish. They have set up quite a lot of these communities in Latin America, with particularly large populations being found in the Yucatan and neighbouring Belize, and the very north of Mexico. The cheese this man was selling was based on Germanic dairy traditions, and it has become quite popular in Mexico, where it is referred to simply as queso menonita, Mennonite cheese. Mexicans are also keen on other dairy products, especially cream, which is often drizzled on top of dishes, and represents another Spanish contribution to Mesoamerican food. If the Mennonites and their cheese, and the Lebanese with their pastor tacos, are surprising contributors to Mesoamerican cuisine, there is another extremely popular dish which comes from an unexpected source, and which also has an interesting history. Alongside all of those tortilla variants, which you can choose to have your fillings prepared in, you will often find that you have the option of having them served in a torta. The word torta has different meanings in different Spanish-speaking countries, but in Mexico it refers to a sandwich made with a soft white roll. Now, bread is another thing where my European upbringing shows in my tastes. I don't like the fact that most bread in the Americas is full of sugar. This is why I love the Mexican torta so much. One day, we will talk properly about the French occupation of Mexico and the rule of Emperor Maximiliano. A brief outline is necessary, however, to explain how this staple of Mexican cuisine came about. In the 1800s, independent Mexico came into conflict with a coalition of European powers, including the British, over unpaid debt. In the end, it was only the French who invaded, and although taking control of the country was difficult, and their defeat in Puebla on the 5th of May as they attempted to reach Mexico City is the origin of the annual Cinco de Mayo celebrations, they did eventually manage it. They placed a member of the Austrian nobility in charge of what they called the Empire of Mexico, and he was chosen because he was a descendant of the Spanish king who ruled when Cortés conquered the Aztec. While it wasn't French territory, it was, in reality, a puppet state, with French soldiers occupying the country. This arrangement didn't last for that long, and eventually the French withdrew in the face of rebellion, and the emperor was removed. The bread which the French brought with them, however, quickly became extremely popular, and so today the torta can be found everywhere. The roll itself wouldn't be out of place in France, but the fillings are those uniquely Mexican ones also used in tortillas. In Puebla, which is alongside Oaxaca one of the poles of Mesoamerican cuisine, they call them semitas. These have the same origins as the torta, so I'm not sure why they're developed to be slightly different, but the semita comes in a round bun instead of a long roll, and has been given a sprinkling of sesame seeds. Often the dough has been shaped to give it a knot on top. Apart from this, though, the semita is pretty much the same as the torta. Another popular variation is the torta cubana. Despite the name, this has nothing to do with what's called the Cuban sandwich elsewhere. It was invented on Cuba Street in Mexico City, and so that's where it gets its name. It is perhaps the most decadent of the tortas, stuffed with pretty much everything you happen to have. Usually strips of beef, ham, sausage, various cheeses, tomato, lettuce, avocado, beans, onion and chili, all at once. A final European contribution I want to mention comes in the form of the paste, usually found in the region just to the north of Mexico City. Here there is a tradition of mining, just as there is on the Cornish Peninsula in England. There the people have a unique Celtic culture. They consider themselves different to the rest of the English, and some of them even want independence. They have been mining tin since before the Romans arrived. It's not hard to find a Cornish pasty in England. They are little pockets of baked dough, stuffed with meat and vegetables, not unlike an Argentinian empanada. According to the legend, it developed because the miners' fingers would be covered in dirt, some of it toxic byproducts of the mining process. Their wives developed the pasty in such a way that the pastry crust could be held and discarded without touching the main section at all. Cornish miners emigrated all over the Americas, wherever their knowledge of the industry provided opportunities. One of these places was this part of Mexico, and the paste is their contribution to Mesoamerican cuisine. The paste differs slightly from the Cornish pasty, in that the beef, carrot and potato is often swapped for local ingredients like beans. If you've enjoyed today's episode, and you're feeling generous, one thing which really makes a difference is if you could leave a review wherever you get your podcast from. It really helps new people to discover the show. If you'd like to get access to an extra episode every month, it's possible to do this by becoming a friend of the podcast for just $2 a month. There's information about how to do this in the episode description. A huge thank you to everyone who's done one of these things already. And thank you to everyone for listening. You've been listening to the Latin American History Podcast.
Written and produced by me, Max Argent. Edited by Alex McNamara. If you want to become a friend of the podcast and gain access to a bonus episode each month, as well as helping to support the running of the show, there's a link with information about how to do this in the episode description. The podcast can also be found on Facebook and Twitter by searching for the Latin American History Podcast. Here, I post updates about new episodes, as well as interesting articles I find about Latin American history. Thank you for listening.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.